And now, welcome to Oasis Forum, where we explore issues that can help us positively evolve our lives, our society, and our planet. Oasis Forum features authors, activists, artists, and healers working to increase our appreciation of the interconnectedness of life on Earth. Each week, we explore a new topic that impacts our health, our families, our communities, our work, and our environment. Our goal is not just to discuss present challenges, but to develop an awareness of root causes and, importantly, to explore potential solutions. At Oasis Forum, our aim is to inspire hope and share practical ideas for creating a world that works for all.
And good morning. This is John Michael, and you are listening to Oasis Forum. And welcome to the Sunday evening. And we have with us in our studio John Berkowitz, who is the full-time director of Southern Vermonters for a Fair Economy and Environmental Protection, an organization with over 1,100 members he founded 4 years ago. John has lived in Putney, Vermont for the past 32 years, where he raised two children, now grown up and long out of the nest, and is a proud grandfather of a 9-year-old. As the name implies, the organization that John heads is involved with economic issues such as economic justice, fair taxes, livable wages, Social Security, challenging corporate power, and much more. And on the environmental side, the Kyoto Treaty petition, the climate change, global warming, renewable energy, energy independence, wind power, and so much more. And we want to welcome you to our studios here tonight. John, thanks for coming.
Thanks. Let's see how much those we can cover.
Yes, let's see if we can. Well, we only have 17 hours. Let's get to it.
That'll do it.
Yes. Why don't we just go ahead and get started with a little bit of a story about you, if you can tell us how you got into this whole field and kind of where you are right now with this.
Well, about 3 years ago, I was working for the Head Start program in Brattleboro, and I had worked at a number of other human service kind of jobs. I worked for the local housing authority and housing issues, working with low-income families and elderly people over in Brattleboro. Before that, it was people with mental health and disability issues, and then most currently the Head Start program. I wasn't a classroom teacher, but I did work with a lot of the families, low-income families that receive Head Start services. So I really could kind of see the effects of poverty and the effects of an unfair economy, as I see it, on our society. And so there is a national organization called United for a Fair Economy. And I went to one of their workshops, and I was just really inspired by the fact that, you know, it's not in the American tradition to have a wide gap in wealth and income. It's not what the founding fathers had in mind. We had a revolution against England, you know, to not have a Boston Tea Party and East India Trading Company. That was really that was like a Walmart, you know, in those days. That was a huge monopoly, and we fought against it. And we fought for a country that wasn't a monarchy and didn't have a great aristocracy of wealth. And sure, lo and behold, 225 years later, we really almost have an aristocracy of wealth. Mm-hmm. And we think there's a lot of ways we can get back to our roots and should get back to our roots and change things for the better.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we go ahead and detail some of those ways? Have at it.
Well, I would say, you know, I'll focus on two things that we've doing recently. And, of course, this is over in Vermont. Our 1,100 members is Southern Vermonters. But I don't think the issues are particularly any different here in Keene or New Hampshire. Obviously, state policies are a little bit different. We can talk about that. But so starting on the lower end, you know, sort of relieving poverty and the people working for $7 an hour, actually that might seem like an enormous amount, because I think New Hampshire's minimum wage is still stuck at $5.15, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. They just voted it up, I think by 2006, it goes up another dollar at the most. It's still way behind what you've got there.
Well, that's at least catching up with a lot of other states, and it should be.
Yeah.
But, of course, the federal level hasn't moved from 515, I think, since 1995, mm-hmm. and Congress still refuses to raise it. So how many millions of people are working for 515 an hour? Mm-hmm. How do you raise a family, pay the rent?
Mm-hmm.
You got to work two or three jobs. You got to work under the table a lot.
Yeah.
So we're working to raise the minimum wage again. Vermont has one of the highest minimum wage. It's mm-hmm. gone to $7 an hour in starting this past January.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got a bill, and we're trying to get – and it's actually passed the House and Senate, but it has to go through the final hoops.
Mm-hmm.
it's going to go up to $7.25 an hour starting next January, and then we're going to work in a COLA, a cost of living adjustment, mm-hmm. to have it go up, you know, just like inflation, just yes. like a lot of people's wages do go up.
Right, right.
So $7.25 an hour, our government, our state government actually determines what is a livable wage in the state of Vermont. They do a study every year. It's mm-hmm. part of the legislature decided to do this. Mm-hmm. But, of course, that was from a lot of citizen pressure from groups like ourselves.
Sure, sure.
We're part of a statewide livable wage campaign.
Right.
Well, they came up in January, as they have done for the last 5 years, and they said a livable wage, meaning how much does it cost, just a basic needs budget. You know, what does it take for an average family, single person, family with no children, family with one child, two, mm-hmm. you know, six mm-hmm. different kind of family mm-hmm. groupings. What does it cost? Well, they came up with $12.37 for a single person.
Right.
And obviously if they're two income earners, but it's still $9 or $10 an hour for two income earners with no children. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, when you think of all the people making $7, $8, $9 an hour, you know, there's about 25% of Vermonters that are not making a livable wage,
mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
it's a real issue,
yeah.
and we're really working to get that minimum wage up, and that doesn't mean that working for $9 or $10 an hour is easy to make it. That's still not a livable wage,
but we're getting there. I know the living wage issue, as I've understood it in the past, tends to focus mostly on government contracts and how people can change the way governments pay people for, you know, doing whatever it is they do for a municipality, for example. It might be something like construction or some other type of consultant coming in to do something. And yet I've often wondered why it wasn't reaching wider, because if you're only getting people working for the government, it's not really going to, you know, affect the lives of people, most people, because most people are not working for the government. So what do you see the basic obstacles are in the way for moving from that admittedly low, even if it's $7.25 an hour, it's still not enough to live on, up to getting closer to that living wage of $12.50 or more? What are the major obstacles you see?
Well, I think you'd have to point to health care as right at the top of the list of major obstacles. And there is a good health care bill. I mean, Vermont, I don't think, is any different than New Hampshire, than any other state. And, of course, we're the states are suffering from the results of federal, national policies. And it hasn't been good even under Clinton, you know, but he couldn't solve the health care issue. But under President Bush, it's gotten significantly worse, because all of our tax dollars, or too many of our tax dollars, have gone to tax cuts, primarily for the wealthiest in the country, mm-hmm. and have gone to, obviously, you know, war overseas and the military budget and weapon systems we don't really need and don't work, you know, like mm-hmm. trying to have a missile shield. You know, like it keeps failing. You know, we're spending all these billions of dollars and it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just priorities. But the healthcare issue, if we could solve that, because so many, you know, working Vermonters or working New Hampshire people are without healthcare mm-hmm. and without health insurance. I mean, mm-hmm. 10% of America, and I'm sure it's 10% of Vermont and 10% of New Hampshire mm-hmm. residents, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of more people are sort of underinsured.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you really look around, I mean, America, you know, with its freedom, and we have the New Hampshire motto of live free or die, you know, we're all in favor of, we're strongly independent, you know, free thinking. But you look around the rest of the world, and they seem to be doing things differently. These are complex societies. These are sophisticated, you know, technological, you know, Germany, France, Japan, Australia. They all have some sort of a national healthcare system.
That's right, they do.
So Canada, so we're just alone in that. And when you really look at the health statistics, you know, we have the fanciest equipment, but we don't have full access to that equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people are afraid to go, elderly people or low income people, afraid to go to the doctor or get that preventive health care,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they could go bankrupt because of it, you know,
exactly.
They don't have the coverage.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, infant mortality and, all kinds of issues, health issues. We're not really at the top. In fact, we're quite a ways down of yeah. other industrialized countries.
Indeed, we are. And I'm wondering why people don't jump up and down saying we deserve something better.
They're starting to jump up and down.
Well, you're one of them jumping up and down. So let me ask you, how your organization works with an issue. Just take this one, for example. You know, how do you craft a strategy in your state or in your locality? Or how do you help people organize, for example, for a fair wage? Taking just that example.
I give you one example. I mean, actually two, now that I think about it. We work with businesses. We had a workshop last fall, and we'll do another one soon. There's something called the Livable Jobs Toolkit. I mean, I sort of want to put that out as a resource for people in the community. And even though it's developed by a group called, not our group, but Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Mm-hmm. That's an organization with hundreds of businesses that want to make a profit and, you know, be a profitable business, mm-hmm. but also have good labor practices, good environmental practices, good childcare, you know, just be a socially responsible business. Mm-hmm. Well, they came out with a Livable Jobs Toolkit a few years ago. It's really full of good ideas for how a business can address the issue of, you know, wages and benefits and all of that. So they're creating a business that's going to attract good employees and retain good employees rather than pay people $7 or $8 an hour with limited benefits. Mm-hmm. And it's not even always they say you got to raise wages because some businesses have a short profit margin, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it says you could look at childcare, you could look at flexible scheduling, you mm-hmm. could look at, they have a lot of strategies for businesses to look at, mm-hmm. all of which have an impact on a family or an individual's budget. Mm-hmm. So even though it may not be directly wages, you know, if that's hard to raise, mm-hmm. but if they offered some childcare benefits or some healthcare benefits or some pensions or flexible scheduling, or, you know, mm-hmm. it's really chock full of good ideas. Mm-hmm. So we had about a packed room of 30 businesses. And some people actually have taken that book and ran with it, you know. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. if there are any business people out there or obviously even just employees, you know, that would like to put that book in their employer's hand, mm-hmm. could be a school or an institution, mm-hmm. could be a nursing home or, a care facility, or it could be just a straight business mm-hmm. with a product. Mm-hmm. It's very helpful. Mm-hmm. So that's one strategy we use. Mm-hmm. And then we work with a lot of groupings of people. I'll give you just one example, paraprofessionals in the schools. Mm-hmm. There are a few areas, Burlington, Vermont, not so much Brattleboro right now, but Bennington, Burlington, where the paraprofessionals, the people working one-on-one, you know, the teacher's aides helping in the classroom, the tutors and paraprofessionals and support staff, meaning kitchen, security, clerical, you know, all those people that are essential for the workings of a school and sometimes doing really important work one-on-one with kids, mm-hmm. sometimes the hardest kids too. They're working for $8, $8.50 an hour. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the way the contracts are set up, their wages go up to $9.50 an hour after 10 years and then are capped there. I'm thinking of Bennington right now. Wow. So 200 paraprofessionals are organizing and trying to negotiate but also build community support in their community, mm-hmm. And awareness of, well, how can somebody who works 10 or 20 years and is really devoted, dedicated mm-hmm. to improving the lives of children and education in the schools, mm-hmm. and they have 3 or 4 or 5 kids. I mean, not everybody, but some families are bigger. And they're working for $9.50 an hour after, you know, 4, 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. Well, they've testified in public. You know, we've had some public forums, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to build community support to negotiate with their school district, their superintendent, you know, to get a fairer wage and benefit mm-hmm. package. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's been going on for several years all over the state. It sort of crops up in different places where there are negotiations mm-hmm. and where there are paraprofessionals who feel like they're really underpaid for an important job.
Mm-hmm. Well, many of those paraprofessionals have to have some kind of degree or an AS or a BA or a BS or something like that. And, you know, given the cost of school these days, unless you're getting free school somewhere in California, but, you know, it's the amount of debt that people come out of school with, I think, what was I reading not too long ago, the average student leaves school with $18,000 of debt or something like that. It's phenomenal then to ask them to, you know, pay back that debt and work for $8.50 an hour. You know, it just doesn't parse. So do you also work at the policy level with the state legislature, the governor's office, to enact or get them to consider new possibilities for laws in the state of Vermont as well?
Well, that just gets back to what we were talking about getting the minimum wage raised. Mm-hmm. I mean, the minimum wage affects about 10,000 Vermonters. Many people think also that they're just the teenagers working part-time right. or, you know, young people, you know, that still live at home. And the reality is 85% of people making $7 an hour, the minimum wage, 10,000 Vermonters, are over 30 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. a myth. Mm-hmm. You know, there's still a lot of people trying to raise their families on $7 an hour. Mm-hmm. So raising the minimum wage at least affects those people. There's still many people just up there at 8 or 9, like the paraprofessionals, right. that also deserve a better wage. But that's a little harder to legislate, and it's hard to go from the minimum wage, $7 an hour, to $12.37. Mm-hmm. We'd like to see the minimum wage wage raised gradually over the next 4 or 5 years, up to $10 an hour. Mm-hmm. And when the floor goes up, everybody else's wages kind of goes up too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's on a policy level.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if I could actually just move now to sort of the other end of the spectrum, the wealthiest Vermonters, and just share with you that, as I sent over some information to you, our most recent project, we organized 32 Vermonters who are at the top 5%, meaning earning $125,000 a year. We held a press conference, and they came to the press conference in the State House 2 weeks ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we are willing, we would like the state, the legislature, the governor to raise our taxes. I mean, they didn't mean just 32 people's taxes that want to do this. They mean the taxes of everybody in the top tax brackets, mm-hmm. which is about 8,000 people making over $125,000 a year. It's like the top 5% mm-hmm. of income earners in the state.
Right.
And they're saying, I mean, I don't know too much of the details in New Hampshire, but given the fact that the federal government is giving less and less money to the states, you know, because of budget and tax policies that are going on under the Bush administration and Congress, well, Vermont is stuck with an $80 million deficit right now in its Medicaid budget. So where do they come up with that money? Mm-hmm. The governor says no new taxes. But what we're saying and what some of the wealthy people that we brought together are saying, there's a precedent. A Republican governor, Richard Snelling, 1991, there was another serious budget crisis.
Mm-hmm.
He raised the taxes only on the top 1%, about 1,800 filers,
mm-hmm.
Making probably at that time, well, over $150,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Now it's higher, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He raised about $19 million and ended that deficit. So we're kind of saying that in order to get out of this real hole, that the wealthiest people who've gotten the most out of our economy and our society and actually got a lot of benefits, you know, education benefits, business regulations, you know, to make sure that, you know, companies were acting fairly and, mm-hmm. you know, fair competition and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've derived a lot. I mean, some of them obviously just inherited wealth, you know, and it's just come down through generations. But
sure.
Many people who have succeeded have done so because of a lot of governmental programs that have helped and you know, set the stage for that. So we're saying, isn't it time that wealthy people could give back to the state of Vermont to help out in a real time of crisis, real time of need?
Mm-hmm.
Because the alternatives are, and the governor is proposing, let's raise the premiums on the people who are on Medicaid. That's low-income working people.
Yeah,
they're already
about,
paying a little premium. It's
yeah.
not just free.
Yeah.
Let's raise the deductibles. Let's raise the copays.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe let's raise the sales tax, you know, in Vermont. We do have a sales tax.
Right.
I know in Vermont, in New Hampshire, there is none.
They'll fight that one to the death, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking here with John Berkowitz, the director of the Southern Vermonters for a Fair Economy and Environmental Protection. And, John, this reminds me of the issue of, I guess, that Clinton got into with welfare, quote-unquote welfare reform. And having worked with that population, as you have, what is your view on how that worked or didn't work and what needs to happen now to take care of those people on that end of the spectrum in terms of finances besides the living wage, which seems to be certainly a step in the right direction?
You know, I'm a little bit out of that. You know, mm-hmm. It's been 4 years now that I worked with families getting Head Start services mm-hmm. or the Housing Authority up until 99 it was. Mm-hmm. All I know is that, you know, welfare reform, I mean, it pushed a lot of people off of welfare
yes.
and into work.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid that a lot of the jobs that people got are just, you know, low-paying jobs mm-hmm. that they're struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you look at economic policies in the state, at least, you know, Walmart coming in, wanting to come in. What kind of jobs is Walmart providing, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It may be some jobs, but $8 an hour with no benefits mm-hmm. and very little health care benefits.
Mm-hmm.
We say we could be doing a lot better. And actually, maybe as a segue into the other part of our work, you
sure.
know, the environment and changing our energy policies, if we were manufacturing wind technology and solar technology and all kinds of clean energy technologies,
mm-hmm.
the, That would create a lot of jobs mm-hmm. in places that have been hurt pretty badly, Springfield area in Vermont, Bellows Falls, but even Brattleboro has lost a lot of factory jobs, industrial.
Yep.
And we're saying so many jobs could be created building a clean energy future mm-hmm. that would clean up the environment as well as create jobs, mm-hmm. you know, for people in mm-hmm. our state mm-hmm. or in really in the whole country.
Sure, yeah.
And then, of course, the third thing is, you know, if we're beginning to manufacture our own energy, we don't need it from overseas, mm-hmm. and so it's going to reduce, not get rid of totally, but it's going to reduce the threat of terrorism and war.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mm-hmm. sort of three good things that energy independence and moving towards, you know, better jobs in the clean energy field could create.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I do definitely want to talk about renewables. But before we leave the economic issue, let me ask you in terms of, you know, again, looking at some of those barriers to a living wage, because that's something I think that affects everyone. Looking at the possibility of raising that wage up to $12.50 or more an hour, you often hear the argument that, oh, everything, all the prices are going to go up, businesses are going to go out of business and that sort of thing. But largely that hasn't happened in the past with the research that I've done when the minimum wage has gone up, because it makes everybody more prosperous. And, of course, they spend their money in the local communities and businesses don't go out of business. So do you run into that kind of argument, and what other kinds of arguments do you run into that seem to be pushing downward on that trend that you'd like to see move upward as far as living wages?
You know, there's no question. I'm not going to just sit here and if there's anybody out there running a small business, you know, or a mom and pop grocery store or, you know, corner store or whatever, it's not easy, you know, going from $7 or $8 an hour for your three employees, you know, just to go to $12 or even go to 9 or 10, you know, quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing we actually say, you know, if a business and that toolkit that I mentioned, it says this is not something you can just do drastically. Some businesses can. But many other small ones with a, you know, limited number of employees, we're saying do it gradually over a year, 2 years, maybe even 5 years, but just make the commitment to go there and take steps in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And once you go in that direction, you know, that's moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just want to say it's not always easy, you know, for all businesses. I recognize that,
mm-hmm.
but there are a lot of, other factors, you know, when employees are paid more, I think it kind of, the money circulates in a community, you know. Mm-hmm. If employees have more money, they have more money to go out and buy things, you know. And generally people making $8, $9, $10 an hour aren't investing their money in the stock market or, you know, place like that. They're going and buying consumer goods, you know, things they need, you know, mm-hmm. for food and furniture and entertainment and, you know, things mm-hmm. in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways you pay your employees more and those employees and other employees, you know, are going to go shop at your store mm-hmm. more. So that's mm-hmm. that's one way it can kind of come back and around.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I just think of there was a great speaker here, right here at Keene State. We helped to bring him here last fall, Jim Hightower. I'm mm-hmm. sure you've heard of him.
I went to that. Yes.
Maybe you were here.
Yep.
Some of your listeners may, you know, he was great. But I always love. He talks about, you know, he grew up in Texas and he has his good old Texas twang. He talks about his conservative father, you know, back in the 30s during the Depression when he was growing up. And his father was a conservative Republican, but it seems like he may be conservative in a different sense than has happened, you know, in the Republican Party in the last, you know, at least currently. Because his father, he says, always used to say, and he was very active in his community and everything, and his father would always say, everyone does better when everyone does better. And I always, it's almost like, you know, you got to kind of toss that around, you know, say it a few times. It's almost confusing, you know, mm-hmm. everyone does better when everyone does better. But it's true, you know, mm-hmm. like when we're all doing better, there's less crime and there's more, people are buying more and we're all, you know, we're in a community. So I always love that. I have a bumper sticker, you know, with that on it. And I think it's an important thing to keep in mind, you know, that as hard as it is perhaps to raise wages for small businesses, that it's the right thing to do. Otherwise, we just kind of keep getting stuck in people feeling stuck with low wages, and then their kids are problems in school because they're working two or three jobs and they're mm-hmm. not getting the attention they need.
Mm-hmm.
And it affects higher people's wages, maybe the store owners, mm-hmm. and their kids in school when the teacher's distracted because some kids haven't got enough to eat and they're coming to school hungry mm-hmm. or they're misbehaving because they haven't had the attention they need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of ripples in our community, in our society, because
Indeed.
Of poverty, because
Indeed.
Of low wages.
Mm-hmm.
So it really can help everyone
mm-hmm.
if everyone does better.
Mm-hmm. So thinking of this money crunch time that we're in, where is the money for the investment in these alternatives that we're talking about now in terms of energy alternatives? which would be solar and wind and other types of things, biomass, and perhaps was coming along, algae as a source of oil, perhaps hemp as a source of fuel. Where's the money, do you think, going to come from for investment? How are we going to change policies in order to get the government to start shifting its reliance on fossil fuels?
Well, it's really right in the news right now. The energy bill, which has been stuck, you know, for years, I think it just passed the House. And the energy bill has always, I mean, you know, a lot of people, some people say, well, wind energy, you know, it gets a subsidy. It couldn't stand on its own. But there have been tremendous subsidies for the oil, coal, gas, and nuclear industries mm-hmm. for the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the bill this year, it includes about 12 or $15 billion in subsidies for the fossil fuel industries mm-hmm. and the nuclear power industry, and about $500 million, which is, you know, it's always been about that ratio mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for solar and wind and mm-hmm. renewables. Mm-hmm. So it's not, it's more the same. It's business as usual. We need to really change that. Those are our tax dollars, mm-hmm. and they're going towards, in some ways, dinosaur industries that we really need to phase out. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, getting into the solution of, you know, clean energy, I think we also need to just briefly dwell on what's the problem? Why do we need to do that? I mean, mm-hmm. not only is it going to help create new jobs, but environmentally, I guess I just really want to say to everybody who's listening in that global warming and the climate changing, it's getting pretty scary. Mm-hmm. And there's several reports in the last 3 or 4 months from some of the top scientists studying this issue mm-hmm. all around the world. I mean, the very top, there's 2,500 scientists in the United Nations. The top guy, Pachauri is his name, he said in January, we're already at the danger point. It's not like something's going to happen in 10 or 20 or 30 years. And if we don't reduce these emissions, these harmful CO2 and, you know, mm-hmm. greenhouse gas emissions, mm-hmm. by 70% mm-hmm. during the next 50 years. Right. But that means we got to start now, not right. just wait 20 years and hopefully, right. you know. He actually used the phrase, humanity may not survive. Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty serious, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to mention there's a few others, scientists, on the West Coast just came out with a study of the oceans. They're finding the oceans are getting acidic. And speaking of algae and plankton and all the little things that each fish from different sizes mm-hmm. eat, you know, the whole food chain and everything, mm-hmm. well, the ocean's getting warmer and getting more acidic, and that's why there's less and less fish, and it's going right up the food chain ultimately mm-hmm. to us. Well, why is the oceans getting acidic? It's the hugest study of the oceans they've ever done. Mm-hmm. And they found the oceans are good at sucking up carbon dioxide. That's a lot of the reason why there isn't more of it in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. you know, causing even with the climate to get hotter. Mm-hmm. But they just said, you know, you've got President Bush and you've got Exxon Mobil and, you know, a very small minority questioning the whole science, questioning the whole, even the truth of global warming. Mm-hmm. Well, these scientists came out and said, you know, you can't deny that the carbon dioxide, the oceans have gotten acidic. How have they gotten acidic? They got acidic because they've taken a lot of carbon dioxide. Well, that isn't because of natural fluctuations in the weather and the climate, mm-hmm. which people always say, well, that's happened over the last eons and millennia, you know, and it's true in some ways. It has fluctuated. Mm-hmm. But how did the oceans in 200 years double their acidity mm-hmm. because they take in carbon dioxide? Mm-hmm. That's so different than, you know, anything that's happened over, you know, 10,000 years mm-hmm. or 2 million years. Mm-hmm. So it just basically says, you know, nobody who's rational anymore can say that we aren't putting up a lot of carbon dioxide mm-hmm. into the atmosphere mm-hmm. and then it's falling into the ocean. So that's mm-hmm. another study, just a couple of examples mm-hmm. Where we've got to act. And, you know, for me, it's like, hey, I raised my kids, they're out of the nest, like I said, you know, mm-hmm. but, you know, you care about they're in their 20s and early 40s. And mm-hmm. but I got a granddaughter, you know, and that's right. a 9-year-old. And right. anybody with kids out there or thinking of having kids or just having a little brother, a little, you know, you think about what we're going to leave, exactly. whether it's 5 years from now or 50, you know, and we've got to act on this. We feel like the Bush administration is just denying it like an ostrich with their head in the sand. Mm-hmm. And the Kyoto Treaty is, it's limited. You know, it's just a very small start, mm-hmm. but it's the one game in town that people all over the world, nations all over mm-hmm. the world, most of the nations except for us and Australia and Saudi Arabia, right, right. maybe a couple others, mm-hmm. are not on it.
Right.
So we got to get started.
Mm-hmm. So how do you see that happening? This we've sort of go from the local to the international. How do we as individual citizens start to affect that national dialogue when there seems to be so much gridlock? There seems to be, you know, so much payola going on. You know, I've heard so many stories of the Bush administration paying off various people to go on air and say certain things that, you know, it's just crooked from one end to the other. What do we as normal citizens do?
Well, I'll actually plug one of our current projects, which is a petition drive. I mean, we didn't start it. We're just participating in it. Mm-hmm. It's called The People's Ratification of the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty. Mm-hmm. And one of the top global warming experts, he's an author named Ross Gelbspan out of Boston. He's sort of pushing this, you know, and a number of organizations in many states. The idea is to get hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of signatures. I'd like to think big, you know, but whatever it is, however many we get. I mean, the point is, we just need to bring citizen pressure to bear. That's what our democracy is about. Mm-hmm. If we don't like a policy, I mean, obviously we wait until election time, but at the same time, even before there's another presidential election or congressional elections next year, if enough people raise their voices and say, this is not right, we've got to do something about this, you know, you bring pressure to bear on a bill or a resolution or or an issue, you know, like global warming. Mm-hmm. We're hoping that will do it. I mean, there's many ways to do it. You know, you can demonstrate, you can petition, you can write letters to the editor, you can go talk to your congresspeople, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. All of them are needed. Mm-hmm. But if anybody's interested, maybe I should just give my website address right now. You know, www.svfeep.net. And the petition is right online on our website. Or you can call up. You know, we're just trying to get this petition out into as many people's hands, circulating, get people to sign it, get as many signatures as we can from around this region, mm-hmm. along with the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how's that going so far? How long has that been circulating?
Oh, just really getting started with it, you know, in the last month or two.
I think it's a great idea. And with the advent of the Internet and, you know, Move On and various other organizations like that, we've seen a lot of really wonderful activism. Not always successful on the larger scale, but we've got to keep working at it, don't we?
Absolutely.
I was wondering if you want to talk a little bit about the Apollo Alliance, which is forwarding some pretty interesting and far-ranging energy changes. And can you give us some of the details of that?
Well, sure. The Apollo Alliance is a, you know, it's a national organization, and it takes its name from the fact that, you know, the Apollo Moonshot program back in the 60s, where President Kennedy said, let's beat the Russians to the moon, you know. In 1961, it was the Cold War, and we were competing with the Russian Soviets for everything, you know. Well, let's get to the moon by 1970. And we kind of put we made a national commitment. We gave money to scientists and technologists, and we put NASA to work. And we kind of, as a nation, got behind, you know, a national program, the Apollo program. And we did it, and we got to the moon. And we're saying that now, in 2005, you know, what we really need is a national commitment to energy independence, kind of for the reasons I gave earlier. Well, one is clearly the environment, global warming, like mm-hmm. we were just talking about. We've got to change the way we fire our homes and our cars, literally fuel our lives, you know, mm-hmm. drive around, heat our houses, light our buildings, run our radio stations, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. We've got to just change, almost just rewire everything, you know, and have the energy come from different sources. Because, you know, oil and gas and coal, I mean, it's brought America such amazing abundance. You know, we can fly around the world and do everything and computers, you know, and yet, so it worked incredible things for the first 125 years, you know, that we use all that fuel. But all of a sudden now, we've come to a point where we look around and we realize that same fuel that made America so rich and prosperous and abundant, and the world in a way, at mm-hmm. least the industrialized world, it's going to undermine our society. It's going to literally bring us down. It's going to end life as we know it. That's the warning of the scientists, mm-hmm. you know, the top scientists. We just can't go on the same path.
Well, not to mention that we're actually running out of the resource at the same time, which, you know, the whole peak oil issue. So we not only can we not keep going because it's killing us that way, but we can't keep going because there isn't enough just to keep this kind of straight line growth path going, especially with India and China coming on as major industrial powers and, you know, China wanting to now all of a sudden buy all kinds of things and competing for the very same oil the United States actually is competing for around the world. They grew, I think, by their energy demand grew by 30% in 2003, and it's just, you know, the world will not sustain that according to most of the reports right now. You know, we've reached that peak or about to reach that peak in oil production, which means, you know, all the oil that's remaining will be more difficult to extract. So we, you know, for those reasons as well as for the environmental reasons we need to start doing something. I think some folks have called this the perfect storm. It's all these different factors converging, you know, our demand on resources and the availability of resources and their effects on the environment and on our ability to take care of ourselves and take care of people. I don't know if people are aware that 40 million adults in the United States, 80 million adults, 40% of the adult population, have asthma or some other kind of respiratory disease, which you put directly to coal fired power plants and, you know, fossil fuel. So this is a big, big issue. People are dropping like flies, canaries in the mine, I keep pointing out. And why aren't people running and shouting at the top of their lungs at these types of epidemics? Because to me, 80 million people, that's an epidemic.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just the greenhouse gas emissions that affects the climate. You know, it's the same emissions that are causing the respiratory, the asthma, and the illnesses and the deaths, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of them. And it's the same emissions that are causing acid rain that are affecting our lakes and rivers and lands and mountains. And that's going to have a big impact on our ecosystems and our recreational lands and, you know, whether the maple trees turn red and beautiful and our tourist industry, you know, it's all connected. So it's the environment, air pollution and acid rain and even mercury. That's coming on now. That's just another byproduct mm-hmm. of burning coal and oil and gas, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. It's almost overwhelming, you know. I'm almost reluctant to mention yet another problem, you know.
Exactly.
Oh, there's mercury, you know. And right. I'm afraid people out there, just like me, you know, your eyes can glaze over. It's true, you know. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, anybody who's got a kid around the house, or you look around, or you know, or you care about your hunting and fishing, and you know what this beautiful place is going to look like mm-hmm. and be like, you know, mm-hmm. for people that are coming after us. Mm-hmm. And you kind of like, all right, it may be overwhelming or seem overwhelming, mm-hmm. but we've got to act and we've got to do something rather than just pretend it's going to go away or mm-hmm. can't do anything about it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So obviously that's what motivates me, and I think an awful lot of other people that are speaking out and standing up and trying to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And you're listening to Oasis Forum on 91.3 FM, WKNH Keene, and we have in our studio John Brigowitz, the director of the Southern Vermonters for a Fair Economy and Environmental Protection, an organization with over 1,100 members that's involved in all aspects of economy, economic justice, living wage, as well as lots of different environmental things. And I'm sure as many of us do, we see these all connected. I'm sure you do as well, John. And moving now into the area of genetically modified organisms, GMO food, what kind of position is your organization taking on that?
Actually, John Michael, I just wasn't quite finished on the Apollo Alliance, and there, you know, if we could take another minute or two,
have at it.
That would be great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Apollo Alliance is really saying that we can clean up the environment, rebuild our economy, create 3 million new jobs, mm-hmm. and reduce terror and war. You know, not have so many of our young people dying or getting wounded in wars overseas, mm-hmm. which I don't think very many people out there, whether they support a war or not, but at least they see it must be a lot about oil, you know, mm-hmm. because we're not importing vegetables from Iraq or Saudi Arabia, you know, and mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the remaining oil reserves mostly are. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're making all these bases over there. And so we're just saying energy independence could really solve some of those problems. And just to give a couple of examples, sorry, just lost my train of thought. If we, you know, the 3 million new jobs, if we started building wind turbines, solar panels, and all kinds of new technologies, you know, we could put the people back to work who lost good manufacturing jobs. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, because of overseas, because of trade policies, that's actually another issues that we work on. Mm-hmm. We think NAFTA has been a tremendous failure mm-hmm. and has not benefited most working people, either in Canada, Mexico, or in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's benefited the big corporations mm-hmm. that have, you know, in the middleman or selling the products, but hasn't been good for the people
mm-hmm.
and hasn't reduced immigration. You know, people are still poor in Mexico and trying to get across to this country. So we just really see it as a huge jobs program that would also clean up the environment. And then building trains, you know, if we really look at mass transit, I mean, Amtrak is kind of a joke, mm-hmm. but mass transit and high-speed trains are not a joke mm-hmm. in Japan and Europe and some other places.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they got bullet trains that are going 200 miles an hour. And sometimes I must admit I haven't been to those places and ridden those trains, but mm-hmm. I sort of like gulp a little bit, like mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, how many times do you hear about one of those trains, you know, going off and, you know, hundreds of people are killed? I mean, I don't think it's ever happened on a large scale like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've had a few smaller accidents, but I think they're generally pretty safe. But in terms of mass transit and moving people around, you know, without having everybody in their own car or SUV, you know, between cities, small cities. So, boy, if we could have a – if we could really resurrect our national train system, which was so important to our communities and our livelihood even just 40, 50 years ago, but then got phased out because of the automobile, that would be a big step towards – you know, creating jobs, building the train system, you know, building the infrastructure, the tracks, that kind of thing, and cleaning up the environment because, you know, we're using less energy using trains rather than so many small airplane trips and, and car trips. So that's – and then fuel economy. We've got to look at – we've got to raise our gas mileage. You know, we just feel like our government is not pushing Detroit to do it. I mean, look at the trouble that General Motors is in right now. Their stock is plummeting. And Ford, I think, is coming along next. And Toyota and Honda are just raking it in. And everybody's trying to get a Prius, you know, or a hybrid, or many people are, you know. They're hot tickets, hot, especially with the price of gas going up. So it's like, you know, when are we going to really insist that Detroit, you know, get the market share and move in that direction, start making the cars – I mean, rather than more and more SUVs and Hummers, you know, it's like.
Well, I remember a couple of years ago there was a petition going around on the internet that said, you know, if you would buy a, you know, a hybrid car from Detroit, you know, sign this petition. And I can't remember who sponsored it, but I know there was a couple hundred thousand people, I think, in the end that signed it. It's like, why is Detroit not taking, you know, the lead from the people and noticing what's happening? I mean, now they're saying, well, we're going to have a hybrid by 2008 or 2009 or something, which would be 10 years after the first one from, you know, Japan came out. So there's a serious lack of leadership really all across the board, in, not only in the economic sector but in the government sector, that somehow doesn't want to, I guess, slap the hand that feeds it. I don't know what that is. But
yeah, there's something really stuck, whether it's in fear or a fear of change. But, I mean, even California, you know, with the worst smog and pollution, you know, and so they passed a law saying by 2009, 30% of all vehicles, new vehicles sold in the state have to be, you know, much cleaner, you know, pollute 50% less, something like that. And who do we find, you know, taking them to court to, because of this law that they passed? But General Motors and Ford and Chrysler and, you know, it's like you can't do that, you know, rather than kind of recognize let's rise to that challenge and let's meet that so that we can beat the Japanese, you know, to the market share that's going to, you know, come from, you know. No, they're fighting it tooth and nail. I can't understand it, you know. But then the Bush administration doesn't give them any and Congress, you know, that goes along with too much of the Bush administration policies. They're not raising the CAFE, the fuel economy standards, and saying, well, you have to do this. This is the right thing to do. And it even turns out that to make the more fuel efficient cars, whether the hybrid or hydrogen, it's going to create more jobs, you know, so that labor unions and other people that might say, well, we can't change because it'll throw people out of work. It turns out that making more fuel efficient vehicles actually creates, you know, I don't know, 10% more jobs than exist currently. So it's a win-win kind of situation.
Well, it's grow or die. I mean, that's what people have been talking about for a long time, and management consultants have been talking about that for the last 20 years. Either growing or dying, you need to learn how to adapt. And this is counter-adaptive, and it seems to me that GM is kind of setting its own demise by just staying in the dinosaur age, which is just too unfortunate for our country. But there it is. Did you want to say any more about energy before we move on to some of these other ones?
Let's move on.
Okay, because we've got about 15 minutes, and we could keep talking all night long. Genetic engineering, nanotechnology, robotics, which would you like to pick out of that pie?
Well, actually, let's sort of put them all together, because these are basically new technologies that have come along in the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, genetic engineering, you know, they're already creating products, you know, seeds. You know, Monsanto is selling seeds that you know, will grow corn and soybeans primarily, you know, and weed proof, you know, especially if you spray this one particular herbicide around it, you know.
Yes, right.
But it's a very controversial technology. But I want to kind of lump it together with genetic engineering with nanotechnology. And I believe there's actually a nanotechnology company in Keene. I don't know the name of it, but I've read there's one in Keene. There's one over in Windsor, Vermont, you know, just up Route 12, I guess it is. So they're popping up. You know, there's 300 or 400 nanotechnology companies. And some people might out. I mean, a lot of people probably never heard of this stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's really just sort of a cutting edge. I don't think there's any products out there right now, but it's moving ahead, you know, in sort of the research and somewhat moving towards development. And a lot of the companies, like the one in Windsor, will say, well, we're creating a way to clean up water, to create little tiny nano means little tiny, miniature, super miniaturized. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think of computers as miniaturized what do they call the boards,
mm-hmm.
Circuit
boards.
Chips and everything.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is really tiny, you know, just bringing things down into a micro nanometer or whatever like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yet things can be computerized, almost atomic level, you know, of things, but they can be computerized and controlled to do certain tasks. So they're proposing we can clean up water, you know, we can take impurities out of water. Well, that sounds great. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not denying it. That mm-hmm. sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
There are all kinds of potential uses. It can actually clean clothes. You know, you can release these little nanobots, they call them. You know, picture little sort of subatomic robots, little things, you know, that can be programmed to do things, to clean up your clothes or purify your water.
Mm-hmm.
And it all sounds great, you know, but so did DDT, and so did nuclear power, and so did nuclear bombs, you know, and a lot of things that we kind of, because we are Homo sapiens, you know, an inventive humanity and all that, and we create these things with technology, but I think sometimes we just move forward too fast.
Mm-hmm.
Some people out there, I've had this conversation with a few people, audiences, you know, and some people just sort of saying, oh, you're just a naysayer. You know, human evolution has just moved ahead because people took risks.
Mm-hmm.
And technology's changed. And look, we've had progress. And, you know, so you can't stop technology. You can't stop the human mind, you know. But I just want to cite the two sources that have really made me sit here and want to talk about this with you and your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
One is a guy named Bill Joy. He's a chief scientist at Sun Microsystems. So this is not just your backyard tinkerer, you know. This is somebody way up there. He wrote a big article in Wired magazine. I don't read that, mm-hmm. but, you know, it was in there, and then it hit mm-hmm. the New York Times. Mm-hmm. This is back in 2000. And he actually said, I'm really worried about these three new technologies, genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and robotics. That's the third one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually literally making robots, you know, and we were sort of seeing the beginnings of that, you know, in Iraq, you know, they have a robot that will go over and try to defuse a bomb, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously that's not a bad use for, mm-hmm. You can make a robot or, you know, mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or for a disabled person, let's say, you know, a robot goes over and does something that, you know, sure, there are some positive applications of science and technology, mm-hmm. no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But he really warned. He said there are so many possible negative applications, very scary applications, and that it's the kind of technologies that even if one person or a small handful, think terrorists, or don't even think terrorists from Al-Qaeda, you know,
mm-hmm.
think terrorists, you know, severe right-wingers or neo-Nazis or, you know, people in our own country that want to just do havoc, you know, that are unbalanced and, you know, want, I mean, these kind of technologies that you don't need an army or you don't need a whole state or you don't need a lot of technology to create, you know, it's, and you let this genie out of the bottle and, you know, some really nasty, evil things. And I mean, they're even saying to the extent that these things could get out of control and end life as we know it on the planet.
Mm.
And that's a pretty heavy thought, mm. but they wouldn't bring it up if they weren't saying that it could really go that way.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the first source that I want to cite. And I really, on our website, we have a copy of that article, or you can just go to Wired or the New York Times and go read the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other one is a guy named Bill McKibben, who teaches at Middlebury College, a pretty well-known environmental author, The End of Nature and all that. He wrote a book 2 years ago called Enough. And he's just basically saying maybe we just really need to say enough to these new technologies until we can really be sure that we can control them in good ways. And that's an open question, mm-hmm. whether we can or can't. Mm-hmm. But at least we ought to really have the conversation as a species, mm-hmm. as a nation, you know, mm-hmm. rather than open up these doors without really even knowing what some of these negative applications are. Mm-hmm. So all I can say is I just really recommend to particularly people, you know, in a sort of ethical job, you know, I'm thinking of ministers, you know, in churches and faith communities, and others like that, that are, you know, really looking at our creation. You know, if you're a person of faith and you believe in whether God or creator, whatever you want to call them, you know, but the creation, and are we tinkering with God or great spirit or creators, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. the creation by making technologies actually change the basis of life, mm-hmm. changing genes mm-hmm. that nature mm-hmm. or, you know, have, that's been there since the beginning. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're moving into a brave new world, you know, mm-hmm. kind of like the book by Aldous Huxley.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've already begun to see some of those negative effects on the butterfly, monarch butterfly species, the pollen from something on corn affected their reproduction or something like that. And so from a genetically modified organism, that particular pollen. So there are these wide ranging effects that we can't control, that we can't really study in advance very easily. And yet the profit motive or the novelty motive seems to be being held up as the greatest good, and we know that it's not. So I don't know how we're going to change the conversation, but I think you've got some good ideas there. Just get more people involved in talking about it. At that point, it can't be all about profits, and it can't be about, you know, getting your quarterly returns in. It's got to, you know, maybe it'll take many, many years before these things can actually be developed in such a way that we can be sure that they're safe. I don't know. How do you see this? How do you see this new conversation happening, given the kind of the corporate-based, corporate-friendly government that we have right now?
I don't think it's happening in a good way. I mean, genetic engineering is right now in Vermont, we have what's called a Farmer Protection Act. It's just passed the House and the Senate, and it's a question of whether it's going to, you know, be vetoed by the governor or, you know, be fully voted into law. But there's plenty of farmers and plenty of people, you know, who are concerned about organic agriculture, you know, want to eat, you know, vegetables and fruits and, you know, eat organically. And they're finding that the genetic, the seeds and the crops that are, you know, in they're finding that just blows in the wind, mm-hmm. In the seeds and lands in another farmer's field. And Monsanto, the company, is suing other farmers, you know, for like patent infringement. It's mm-hmm. a little crazy, but mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. they've actually won. They put some farmers out of business.
Yeah.
And so basically what we have is just a liability law. It's not even necessarily saying genetic engineered crops are good or bad, mm-hmm. but it's saying if they're so good, then why doesn't the company, why aren't they liable if it contaminates another farmer's field that doesn't want to grow them? You know, talk about freedom, the mm-hmm. basic freedom of mm-hmm. choice. If a product is so uncontrollable that, you know, the farmer next door wants to grow organically, or just even if they're not growing organically, they just don't want to have genetically engineered crops, and they're, you know, mm-hmm. they don't have a choice. And yet the plant lands in their field and grows, mm-hmm. you know, and they're sued for patent infringement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a little crazy making, but that's actually what's happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we're moving ahead so fast. Just single corporations like Monsanto are really controlling the whole development of a crop like that. And then you've got other countries around the world, like you remember that story about that African country that, you know, was so hungry, Zambia, I think it was, but they said no thank you to getting our surplus corn because it was from genetically engineered. And you'd think, oh, wow, their people are starving. You know, how could they turn this down?
Right.
But they're seeing, well, we start planting these seeds, you know, and then all of our own crops are – they don't really trust the genetically mm-hmm. engineered crops.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they got to buy them all from Monsanto.
That's right. That's right. Monsanto then has created the Terminator seed, which creates no seed, correct? Which means, you know, that when it flowers, it doesn't create any more seeds, so they're forced to continue to buy from Monsanto, which is pretty insane if you think about it. So what do we do? What do some ordinary citizens do about that?
Well, I don't know what's going on here in New Hampshire, and hopefully there's people speaking out and educating themselves about the issue. And I don't know if there's any bills in the legislature, but as I said, there's a Farmer Protection Act, which has drawn widespread support from the farming community. I don't mean all of it, you know. And yet the Agriculture Secretary under Governor Douglas has said, I don't think there's a big problem here, and he's really seems to support the industry more. But we've got a Democratic legislature, and this Farmer Protection Act, I'm hoping, will go through. It would be the first in the country for a state to say a company that sells genetically engineered seeds and products must be liable for any damages, you know, caused by their product.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like also a no-brainer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If a company thinks their product is good and safe, then why don't they just say, well, we'll be liable if we have any accidents, mistakes, or damages happen, you know.
Mm-hmm. And how? And just let me ask: how is damages defined in this particular case? Is that the cross pollination with other farmers' fields? Is that considered damage?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the organic market, you know, in this country is booming. You know, people really want to feel like they're eating, you know, clean, healthy foods. And if well, first of all, you can't get an organic label. You can't be certified organic if your fields have been contaminated with genetically engineered products. I mean, mm-hmm. Genetically engineered corn or anything is not considered an organically grown product. It's still considered it may not be proven unhealthy yet, but there's enough questions, you know, that it may be. Mm-hmm. And what are the ramifications of growing it, and, you know, what else could happen genetically? Anyway, it's not organic. So meanwhile, you got farmers trying to grow organic, whatever it is, milk or, you know, crops, you know, and their seeds their fields get contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
There goes your organic sector.
Mm-hmm.
It could go really fast, you know, if too many genetically engineered crops are planted.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know how far, off the top of my head, know how far pollen travels, but it can be quite a few miles, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, isn't that essentially saying to Monsanto goodbye? I mean, you're really saying get out of here with that law, pretty much, aren't you?
Well, I mean, not necessarily. You're really saying, it's not even saying you can't. Well, I'll be honest. I mean, our organization and many others, we do want a moratorium on the sale and distribution of genetically modified seeds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'd like that.
Mm-hmm.
But even while we're working towards that and feel like that should happen, until that technology is really proven safe, in the meantime, at the very least, there should be a liability law so that the company that's selling these products is liable for damages.
So how is that law doing? How's the conversation around that going?
Like I said, it's passed the House and I believe the Senate. Now it's, you know, getting discussed. And of course, Monsanto is spending, you know, gazillions of dollars, you know, to try to defeat it. And other corporate interests. And the governor and the ag secretary don't seem to think there's too big a problem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very big issue around the state. You know, Vermont really prides itself on its agricultural sector, and obviously organics are growing bigger and bigger, and this is a threat.
Yeah.
So
we have about a couple minutes left. I'm wondering if you want to tell folks anything about what your organization is doing, anything on the calendar coming up or other projects that you have going that you'd like to let folks know about?
Just to talk a little bit about 9/11, the attacks on about 9/11. You know, because it really is, you know, the Bush administration has claimed that now we're in a war on terror and, you know, we're kind of on a war footing and we've got to spend all these millions of dollars on occupying Iraq and Afghanistan and, you know, is it going to be Iran next or Syria or what, you know? And I just want to encourage people to, and again, go look on our website. I'll mention it again, www.svfeep. Hope those letters .net, svfeep.net.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some. I just read a couple books in the last year that just opened my eyes to what I consider the fact that we haven't been told the full truth about what happened on 9/11. Because there's so many factors. I'll just give one example. How come our Air Force didn't go up and intercept any of those airplanes? And when you really look at all the evidence and these books, and these are not kind of wild-eyed radicals. This is a theology professor named David Griffin from California who wrote a book called The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. Well, I mean, he was a skeptic of a lot of these so-called conspiracy theories for a long time himself. Mm-hmm. But he finally really dug and did a lot of research and looked at these questions, these unanswered questions of so many people. If you go on the web, there's lots of different websites. Mm-hmm. And even some of the families of the victims of 9/11, the Trade Center and the mm-hmm. Pentagon, mm-hmm. even some of them are very concerned that they haven't been sort of told the whole truth. And there's so many questions like, well, how come the jets weren't, how come they couldn't have stopped some of these attacks? You know, mm-hmm. how come they weren't scrambled? And when you really dig around and look, mm-hmm. Like this guy has done, you realize they were scrambled 157 times in the last year over lots of any little jet or airplane that went off its course. And they were up there in 10 minutes, you know, escorting those jets safely or, you know, preventing any incidents. Mm-hmm. How come not this day? And maybe you say, well, the Trade Center, they only had half an hour's notice. Well, it should have been enough anyway. But then what about the Pentagon? You know, that was like 55 minutes after the Trade Center. And how come they couldn't protect the Pentagon, the source, the center of our military establishment? So that's one example that when you read the evidence, you just can't help but think we haven't really – it just doesn't add up. And I can, you could probably talk about 30, 40, 50 examples like that. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the National Commission, the 9/11 National Commission, they gave their report last July. Mm-hmm. The same author wrote a book about, you know, how that commission didn't really look deeply at and come up with some answers to some of the unanswered questions, mm-hmm. that they actually sort of skimmed over a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And it's not a thorough report. Mm-hmm. So we have a couple of examples of this guy's work on our website, or you can go to his website and mm-hmm. get it all, or go to the bookstore and get the books. But mm-hmm. I just think until we really question what we're being told by our government, mm-hmm. we're going to be, yanked around by every orange alert and, well, we have to go to war next, you know, because we're being threatened. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of questions about whether the Bush administration didn't allow this attack to happen mm-hmm. and actually maybe work with it. I mean, it's a strong thing to say, you know, and some people might just really shake their heads, but you got to read these books, mm-hmm. and they're not really wild-eyed, you know, way off in left field conspiracy theorists. Mm-hmm. There's some pretty reasonable people writing about this mm-hmm. who've done some really strong research. Mm-hmm. All I can say is it really made an impact on me, and I really urge people to look at it.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And on that note, we're up at the end of the hour here.